Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll free, 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Second hour of Open Forum today on Catholic Answers Live. 888-318-7884, the number. Any question that you have on our Catholic faith, we are happy to address that. Whether you share that faith with us or not, whether you're Catholic, not Catholic, or anything in between that you can imagine, we welcome your call. And on any aspect of the life, the faith, the Catholic of the Catholic Church, maybe about Christian history, maybe about morals, any of those, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of so many things, but most recently A Daily Defense. I'm talking about books.
Right.
Welcome, Jimmy.
Thank you. It sounded like you were suggesting being Catholic is a graded rather than a quantum phenomenon.
Wait, what did I say?
Well, you said whether you're Catholic or not Catholic or something in between. That suggests that being Catholic is not a binary on-off quantum state, that it's something that that admits of gradations.
Well, could we be on our way? And so, like, does there always have to be a moment where I'm not and then a moment where I am?
Well, that's what I'm asking. Or, I'm just asking how you're conceptualizing.
Or is it possible to say that some people might be fully Catholic, they might be Catholic, but not in full communion with not fully in communion with the Catholic Church?
Now you're drawing in some elements from the Second Vatican Council's document, Lumen Gentium.
Trying to save myself. I'm just treading water here.
So it's, you know, it depends on how you look at things.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you'll find that many things that we hold most dear depend greatly on our point of view.
Wait. What does that come from, that quote?
Empire Strikes Back.
Oh.
It's actually Return of the Jedi.
Oh, I actually find that inappropriate. That as we're in the
30s. You think that things don't
No, I think quoting Star Wars on the 35th anniversary of the Wrath of Khan being released.
Oh, is today the 35th
inappropriate,
anniversary?
Jimmy. I think it was actually 2 days ago, but...
You task me, Cy Kellett. You task me.
Sorry. Are you familiar with the movie Wrath of Khan?
Of course. I just quoted it.
Yeah. Well, I always assumed you quote things that you're not familiar with. But if you are. Did you like the Wrath of Khan?
Yeah. It was a good movie. It is widely considered the best of the Star Trek movies. I don't know that I consider it the best of the Star Trek movies, but it is one of the good ones.
What is the Star Trek movie, if I may ask you one more Star Trek question before we go to the lines, where the Klingon guy says that he loves Shakespeare, especially in the original Klingon?
That's Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country,
which is one of my favorite lines.
It's perhaps my favorite of the movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think it's arguably the best. Obviously, it's one of the even numbered ones because that's the pattern with the original Star Trek movies. All the even numbered ones are good. The odd numbered ones are bad. So 2, 4, and 6 are your good ones. Khan, whales, and the Cold War ends in space.
Wait, what was the second one? Whales?
Whales, yeah. Star Trek IV, The Search for Whales.
Yeah. Where do they keep the nuclear
vessels? The nuclear vessels, yeah.
Another great line from – actually, I had forgotten that Star Trek had so many good lines in it. I was thinking –
it's very quotable.
It is, yeah. But sometimes you're quoting it and I don't realize you're quoting it. Well, happy 35th anniversary of The Wrath of Khan.
Likewise.
Thank you. I never knew that we would make it this far, me and the Wrath of Khan. We have loads and loads of calls, Jimmy, and it is open forum. Scott in Smithfield, Virginia is listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite Radio. Scott, your question for Jimmy Akin.
First of all, I want to clear something up. Star Wars is better than Star Trek.
We just lost a call. Oh, I'm so sorry. The caller dropped. What happened? Just kidding there, Scott.
Yeah, just remember that old Latin saying, de gustibus non disputandum est.
Scott, if you know the answer to that.
There's to be no disputing about taste.
Oh, I was going to quiz him on it.
No.
Go ahead, Scott. What's your question?
Okay. So I guess my question has to do with do not judge, that common phrase that goes around. What's the difference, would you say, between judging and administering honest discipline when there's the possibility of scandal or something?
Okay. When Jesus is talking about do not judge, he's not speaking in a courtroom context. And when discipline is administered, say, by a church tribunal because someone has done something wrong, or by a secular tribunal, that's not what Jesus is talking about. Jesus is talking about something that we're prone to in our own personal relationships out of a courtroom setting, that it kind of resembles what happens in a court. You know, in a court, you have someone who's accused of doing something wrong, and then the court finds them guilty or not guilty, and thus judges them, and then they are either released or they have punishment administered. And we have a similar process that happens in our ordinary lives, where we see other people doing things, and we are inclined to say, "Hey, that's a bad thing that this person did," and you may then hold it against them, and there can be negative consequences for that person and for your relationship with that person and for you if you are too quick to judge others in that way. And so that's really what Jesus is warning against. He's urging an attitude of forgiveness and compassion and giving people slack, you know, not being just rigorously harsh with them and jumping on every little thing they do, giving them the benefit of the doubt. He's advocating a general approach to human relations, but he's not talking about what actually happens in a legal context. Jesus recognized the role of laws and courts in civil society, and so he wouldn't say, you know, no judge in a courtroom should ever render judgment. He wouldn't say that at all. In fact, Jesus himself has been appointed by the Father as the judge of the living and the dead, to judge all of mankind at the end of the world. So he obviously doesn't have a problem with the concept of judging, but what he does have a problem with is judging people harshly and rashly and constantly. And he wants us to show mercy to each other because, as he said, by the measure you use, it will be measured to you. And if you want mercy from God, you need to show mercy to others.
Caller?
Okay. I mean, I have another part of it, but I also know you got a lot of the caller, so I don't want to drag on.
Well, I'm not going to judge you for that, and I'm actually going to accept that because we do have a lot of other callers, and I think we can get one more in before the break. I really appreciate the call.
Call back again.
Yeah, please do. We go now to Jeff in Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Jeff, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. I hope I don't lose you. I'm driving through hills.
Well, let's make
we'll
the
drive
best
over
of the time we have.
Around
What's
them?
Your question?
My question is about the Pope and how historically all bishops were seen as equal. And even historically, I think it was maybe Pope Gregory, I don't know if it was the first or the third, who took offense to the Patriarch of Constantinople taking on the
title of universal
ecumenical
bishop. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so then, I don't know, 1,000 or 1,500 years later, then the Pope gets this elevated position above other bishops.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that seems, I don't know if it's hypocritical, but it seemed like a double standard.
Okay, Jeff, let me ask you a question. What faith background are you coming from?
All of them. I grew up Catholic. I was Protestant. I'm now coming from an Orthodox perspective.
Okay. I'm going to put this as kindly as I can. The perspective you just articulated historically is not grounded in the facts of history. I'm not blaming you for that. I'm sure that you're repeating what you've been told, but the idea that all bishops have historically been regarded as equal does not correspond to the facts of history. That's never been the case. It's certainly not the case that the Pope for 15,000 or 1,500 years, as you said, didn't have a special position and then suddenly that came out of nowhere. That's not the case at all. If you go back to the writings of the early fathers, there's a recognition, and this predates the universal bishop or ecumenical bishop controversy that you referred to. There's been a recognition of different levels of prestige among bishops and levels of authority among bishops for a long time. That's why in the East you have metropolitans. And you also have patriarchs of various sees. And you go back to, say, the Council of First Nicaea in 325 and the other early ecumenical councils, and they're talking about the different patriarchs of the major sees, you know, Jerusalem and Antioch and Rome and so forth. And so the idea that all bishops have always been regarded as equal is just not true. Now, they're all equal in the sense that they're all equally bishops, so they have a common sacramental grade. There's not one bishop who has more bishopness than another. They're all equally bishops. That's a binary state. It's either on or off. You're either a bishop or you're not. But among those who are bishops, there have been different levels of prestige and authority so that, for example, metropolitans could make certain decisions in their areas. Patriarchs could make certain decisions in their areas that would affect other bishops in their territory. And it has been recognized all the way down through history that the Bishop of Rome has a unique role among all of the bishops of the world. And the reason for that is because he's the successor of St. Peter. Even among the apostles, there were distinctions. The apostles, while they were all equally apostles, they weren't all equal within the College of the Apostles. Thus, James and John and Andrew and Peter are singled out on various occasions among the other apostles to participate in special things that Jesus was doing, like the Transfiguration. He did not take all 12 apostles up the mountain with him. We're told very explicitly it was Peter, James, and John. So even within the group of the 12, there's a core group. And then within that core group, St. Peter is the clear leader. This is evident from the way Peter is handled in the Gospels in passage after passage and the book of Acts. He's the one who speaks for the Gospels. He's, of all of the original 12, he's the one mentioned far most frequently. And in three of the four Gospels, in Mark, Luke, and John, we have Jesus singling out Peter, giving him a special pastoral role among the other apostles. So in John, he asks Peter, do you love me more than these, the other people being the other core disciples who were there? Peter says, yes. He says, feed my sheep, thus including the other people who were there. In Luke 22, Jesus, when the question comes up of who's the greatest among the apostles, Jesus first assures them, he first teaches them the principle of servant leadership, that they shouldn't be hung up about that question, but then he assures them they're all going to have authority in God's kingdom. But then he tells Peter, I've prayed for you, and when you've turned back, strengthen your brethren. So he gives Peter a special role pastorally among the other apostles. And then, of course, most famously, in Matthew 16, Jesus says, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. So he makes Peter foundational to the governance of the church. And if the church needed a leader like Peter in the first century when it was just starting out and had only a few hundred or a few thousand members, when it grows to the size of millions and now over a billion members, it's going to need a leader like that all the more. And so it's always been recognized down through history that the Bishop of Rome is the successor of Peter and has this unique role among all of the other bishops of the world, and that ministry has been manifested in different ways down through the years, but it's always been there, and it's always been recognized. And obviously, if one bishop, such as the Patriarch of Constantinople, tries to arrogate a role to himself that he has not been given, that's obviously going to cause problems. But there's not a hypocrisy or a double standard going on here, because this is just the continuation through history of a pattern that Jesus set up right there during his own earthly ministry.
Jeff, I hope that that was helpful for you. We have to take a quick break, so we will be back right after this with more on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Are you coming to the Catholic Answers Conference this September?
You guys put on a great show, so it's well worth coming.
Very powerful, very motivational and moving.
I think it's awesome. It's been really amazing to get to know people from all across the country.
Every time somebody's speaker finishes, I feel like I want to cry just because of how happy I am.
It's been pretty phenomenal. Very educational, enlightening.
This year's conference is September 28th through the 30th here in beautiful San Diego, and we want to see you there. Seats are still available, but act now because they are going fast. Call us today at 1-888-291-8000 or visit CatholicAnswersConference.com now and reserve your spot.
This is where it starts, and it definitely has started for me.
We as Catholics need to stand strong, to be prepared to mount a daily defense, to respond to the many challenges that we, as believers, are presented with every day. Jimmy Akin is here to help. His innovative new book, A Daily Defense, takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, 366 in all, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, with challenges and answers indexed alphabetically, so finding the answers can be quick and easy. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Open forum this hour on Catholic Answers Live. One line open, 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. If you have a question having to do with the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, Jimmy, you're getting my attention. What's up?
Yeah. So the intrepid Darren Delosier just pointed out something to our attention in the break that we should have thought to mention earlier, and that is Khan Noonien Singh, a.k.a. Ricardo Montalban.
Yes.
Of also Mr. Rourke of Fantasy Island.
Oh, yeah.
That show, was a friend of the ministry of Catholic Answers. He's passed on. It's been a number of years since he's passed on. But back during the 1990s, he did a number of things with us here at Catholic Answers. He was a faithful Catholic, and he appeared here on Catholic Answers Live. He wrote a fundraising letter for us. He was interviewed in a magazine we were doing at the time called B Magazine. So he actually had quite a bit of interaction with us here at Catholic Answers, and never once tried to kill us in the Mitara Nebula.
So Khan would.
He was a really, really good guy.
Good for him.
Us.
Oh, yeah. That's great. What a great story. And so he played
Khan Noonien Singh.
Yeah, in The Wrath of Khan, 35-year-old movie. Did you know his story at all? Like, was he a late in life convert or a lifelong Catholic?
No, he was of Spanish, Hispanic origin. So he was raised Catholic. Uh-huh. And I don't know, probably like a lot of people in show business, he may have had times where he, you know, was leading a more active faith life than others. But but he was a faithful Catholic. He was serious about his faith. The stories I remember him telling are things I've seen in interviews with him and stuff, and they're not as much about his faith. I remember – some of them are pretty funny though. I remember once he was being asked about learning English, mm-hmm. Because Spanish is his first language, and he was pointing out something that anyone who's studied related languages knows, which is you can often build vocabulary in one language if you can find words that have similar origins.
Oh.
So in a language you're familiar with. So like in English and Spanish, no is really easy. You know,
yeah.
It's the same word in both languages. So those words are called cognates. If they have a similar origin, then they tend to have similar form and you can build vocabulary quickly. And he had noticed this too because he was learning English as a boy. And he had noticed that there are a lot of words in English that kind of are similar to words in Spanish because we have a lot of the same roots to our languages, Greek and Latin and so forth. And one day he was at a bus stop waiting for a bus to go to school, and there was a girl there he was kind of hoping to impress, but he had a cold, you know, mm-hmm. and he was kind of uncomfortable because he had this cold. And the girl asked if he was okay, and he kind of winced and said he was trying to think of what the English word for cold would be because he didn't know what you call that. And he thought and he said, constipation. Because in Spanish, a cold is a constipation of the nose. And he unfortunately failed to impress her on that occasion.
Or he may have impressed her a great deal, just not in the way he wanted to. Well, I'm so glad we got to remember Ricardo Montalban.
Yeah.
And on this anniversary of the Wrath of Khan. 888-318-7884, the number. Rodney in Norfolk. Now, you have to tell me, Rodney, how you pronounce that. I'm told you pronounce it differently in Nebraska. How do you say the name of your town? Rodney?
Norfolk.
Norfolk. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Norfolk. All right. Your question for Jimmy.
In 1 Timothy 2, verse 5, it is written, quote, "There is one God and one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus." Mm-hmm. And also in the Gospel of John, Yeshua said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me."
Yep.
So how can the Roman Catholic Church consider Mary as the mediatrix of all graces?
Well, so one has to realize that language is a very fluid phenomenon. A single word can be used in multiple different senses. And this is something that's obvious. We all know this. We all realize this. If I'm in a doctor's office and I hear the phrase or the sentence, "put the kitty on the table," I'm going to interpret the word kitty differently than if I am at a poker game and I hear someone say, "put the kitty on the table." The word kitty in those cases has two completely different meanings. In the one case, it means a small cat or at least a cat of some kind. In the second case, it means a pool of money or poker chips that people are using to start the betting. And so a single term can have very different meanings. And that means whenever we encounter a term in Scripture, we have to ask, or anywhere else, we have to ask, how is this term being used among the different meanings it may have? And so when we and we have to recognize that there may be other meanings that we need to take into account too. So when we read in 1 Timothy that Jesus is the one mediator between God and man, that certainly identifies Jesus as having a unique form of mediation, a unique role as a mediator. But we have to say, well, is he the only mediator that ever functions between God and man? Well, it would seem the answer is no, because if you look elsewhere, such as in the book of Galatians, Paul talks about the old covenant, the Mosaic covenant, that Moses was the one God used to bring into effect. He talks about how that covenant was put into effect through a mediator, and that mediator was Moses. So on that occasion, Moses mediated between God and man. So we have to say, well, Jesus is a unique mediator. He's the mediator of the new covenant, so he's unique as a mediator in that sense. He's also uniquely the God-man. He's the only person who's both God and man, so he's uniquely a bridge between God and man in that sense. But that doesn't mean the term mediator can't be used in other senses. It can be used of Moses, as Paul himself elsewhere does, and it can be used for other people who play a role, for example, in intercessory prayer. And we know intercessory prayer is a good thing because actually right there in the same passage in Timothy, Paul is recommending that people engage in intercessory prayer for others. And he then leads up to the statement, because there's one mediator. So all of our individual intercessions are something that are summed up in the mediation of Christ, but that doesn't prevent us from being able to pray for others. And it doesn't prevent us from serving as Paul elsewhere says, ambassadors for Christ. And so there is a kind of intermediary function that other people, whether they're the Apostle Paul or just an ordinary, humble believer praying for someone, there are intermediary functions that other people play underneath the overall ministry of Christ. And that sets the context for understanding the role of Mary. She's not independent of Christ. She's not superior to Christ. But she is a unique follower of his based on her relationship with him as his mother. And she thus plays a unique role under the mediation of Christ as well.
We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
We've all heard the phrase, the new evangelization. In previous centuries, missionaries would travel to foreign lands to evangelize, but today's missionaries are more likely to focus on fallen away Catholic neighbors or relatives. But what about the old evangelization? The two millennia of Catholic missionary efforts by the likes of St. Paul, St. Augustine of Canterbury, St. Francis Xavier, and most importantly, our Lord himself. We must not forget the methods they used to spread the faith to the farthest reaches of the world. Our situation may be new, but the essentials of evangelization always remain the same. In his new book, The Old Evangelization, How to Spread the Faith Like Jesus Did, author Eric Sammons provides a practical guide to putting these essentials into practice in everyday use in your interactions with family, friends, coworkers, and even fellow parishioners. Order your copy of The Old Evangelization today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What are miracles, and why does God work them? How can I believe in miracles if I've never experienced one? Aren't miracles just something pre-scientific people made up to explain what they couldn't understand? 20 Answers Miracles unpacks the nature of miracles, their appearances in Scripture and history, how the Church evaluates them, and ways to answer doubters who say they're mere superstition. 20 Answers Miracles is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Father Robert Spitzer.
First of all, you will get a much deeper awareness of your faith, much deeper awareness of the evidence for your faith, explanations of tough theological issues, how science and reason and faith come together, and above all, a deeper awareness of how to practice your faith and how to live it.
Father Spitzer's Universe with Father Robert Spitzer. Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Love that groovy Thursday moon music. That means it must be the midst of second hour of Open Forum on Thursday. And that is exactly what it is, Open Forum. Any question you've got about the Catholic faith, we're happy to take it. Jimmy Akin is here as our guest, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And Jimmy, we go now to Brian in Los Angeles, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Brian, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, Jimmy, my question's regarding my patron saint, who is James the Just.
Okay.
And I was wondering, based on Acts 21 and also an article I read of yours on Ebionism, did he believe that Jewish Christians were still in some way obligated to the Mosaic law even after the resurrection? If so, should his beliefs have any impact on how Jewish Christians observe the faith today, even though it's not mandatory?
Okay. It's unclear whether he thought Jewish Christians were obligated to keep the Mosaic Law or parts of it. He certainly didn't encourage Jewish Christians to cease keeping the Mosaic Law, and so he thought it was permitted for them to do so. And and the church has historically understood that to be something that had a place in the life of the church during this kind of transitional period where the gospel was first being proclaimed to the nations, and you know, even then the temple was still there, and so it could make sense to, you know, continue to go and offer sacrifices there. But there have been shifts in the way that history has unfolded. So today there is no temple, and today even people who are non-Christian Jews recognize they shouldn't be performing animal sacrifices various places because there is no temple. And so in the same way, Jewish Christians shouldn't be doing that. And so obviously they're not meant to be keeping the full law of Moses. And as Christians, based on what is revealed to us through other channels, such as the writings of St. Paul, which of course are divinely inspired, like all scripture, including the Epistle of James, we know that even Jewish people are not obliged to keep the Mosaic Law because Jesus fulfilled the Mosaic Law, and thus, as St. Paul says, he's the end of the law for those who believe. And that's why Paul could not keep kosher and eat with Gentiles, for example. And as he says in the Corinthian epistles, he becomes all things to all people that he may win some to Christ. And so he didn't feel obligated to keep the Mosaic Law. He at times would go through the motions. He would outwardly observe it because he didn't want to offend Jews, but he wasn't obliged to do so. And it's that perspective that the church has adopted and understands to be the one that's the case today. So if you're a Jewish Christian, you may observe certain things just as a matter of culture or habit, or acknowledging your history, ethnically and religiously. But in terms of what your actual obligations are, you're not obliged to observe the Mosaic Law. You, like all other Christians, are obliged to observe the law of Christ.
Okay, that's great. Appreciate it, Jimmy.
Sure thing.
Thank you very much, Brian. I appreciate that call. Jimmy, did I ever tell you that I have a daughter studying comedy in Chicago?
You're kidding.
No, I really do. Uh-huh. I have a daughter who studies comedy in Chicago, and I tell you that because I would like you, to, if she ever calls the show, to be nice to her.
Okay.
And this is her. Hi, Sophie. Thanks for calling Catholic Answers Live. What's your question?
Hi.
Dear daughter for Jimmy Akin.
Hello. Hi, Jimmy. I have a question because I'm in a comedy studies program in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking about, because I'm in a comedy theory class, so I'm thinking about the relation between comedy and religion. And I noticed that in the Bible, there's a lot of talk of joy and, you know, but not a whole lot on laughter. But I'm wondering what the church's stand is on comedians and their kind of dedication to crafting humor and kind of dedicating themselves to crafting essentially joy for people, and also what the ceiling is to that humor. Because it seems
ceiling?
Like everybody's got a different ceiling to what they will laugh at versus be offended by.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, the church's position is that comedians, like actors in general, are participating in the devil's playhouse. And so this is among the works of iniquity, and you need to go to confession as quickly as possible and find a different avocation. You need to use your life in the service of God.
You should probably be a nun, don't you think? You
know.
Okay, Sophie, thanks for calling.
Right on that.
Hope you'll call back sometime.
I'm running out the door right now.
Okay, so let's back up and give a more serious answer. Humor is a fundamental part of human experience, and even though it's never mentioned that Jesus himself laughed, it is mentioned that he rejoiced, and laughter is one of the ways that we manifest rejoicing. It is something that's just a fundamental part of human nature, and this came home to me a number of years ago because I was friends with a family that included a girl who was deaf from birth, so she had never had the experience of hearing laughter. I mean, never. But I remember her being 5 years old and running around screaming and laughing with joy at the play that she and her brothers and sisters were doing. And so this is a child who had never even heard laughter. I mean, you could say, well, maybe she would mime it based on seeing it. But no, she wasn't miming it. She was laughing. And that showed me just how integrated laughter is to human nature. And so even though laughter is not mentioned a lot in Scripture, actually there is a good bit of comedy in Scripture. Jesus is known, for example, for using irony. This is one of the things, and irony is a form of comedy. And he'll even do so using sarcasm, sarcasm being another form of comedy. When Jesus calls people blind guides, that's ironic. That's comedy. It's not necessarily the kind of comedy that's meant to provoke laughter, but it is the kind of comedy that is meant to provoke a recognition of the contrast that is present in the concept of someone guiding others but nevertheless being blind. And that's something that's fundamental to all comedy. All comedy rests on a kind of conflict conceptually, on one level or another. There's always some kind of conflict in comedy, and that's rooted in what comedy actually is. Comedy is a form of play. We actually see parallels to comedy in other species related to us, including, for example, apes, among our closest relations in the creatures of this world. Apes have a kind of play they engage in where they have a kind of panting behavior that resembles human laughter. And we also see other animals. We see puppies and kittens playing. And one of the things that you realize if you think about play, and I've talked about this in other circumstances, is that play is a form of simulation. It prepares us for experiences that we may have later in life that we'll need to know how to handle ourselves in. So that's why puppies and kittens will play fight. And they're enjoying themselves. They need to enjoy themselves in order to engage in this behavior. So that's the incentive for them, as they are incentivized by the fun they're going to have to play fight as a way of learning how to handle themselves in a real fight. And in the same way, that's why children, like little boys, play cowboys and Indians or cops and robbers or red team versus blue team or whatever it happens to be these days. It's, again, a form of fun, safe simulation for something we're going to encounter later on in life where we may need to know how to handle ourselves in a real fight. And in the same way, comedy is a form of play that prepares us for conflict in other ways. All comedy involves some kind of conflict usually on a conceptual level, although there also is physical comedy. But we need to know how to handle ourselves in conflict situations, and comedy is a safe, enjoyable way of learning that, of simulating that, and being ready for that later on in life. And so the comedic impulse, like all drama, is an outgrowth of this fundamental principle that God has built into our nature and into the natures of other species as well. And so it's a fundamentally wholesome activity. It's a good thing to do. Like anything else, though, it can go too far. If you watch puppies or kittens playing, you know, they're having a great time until suddenly someone bites or scratches too hard. And at that point, it's no longer the safe, fun play. It's become something destructive, and a real fight can start as one of the puppies or kittens tells the others to back off. And in the same way, you can say things in comedy if you, so to speak, bite too hard or scratch too hard. You can say things that really hurt other people and go beyond comedy and turn the safe, fun play experience into an actual hurtful experience that can lead to a fight and can turn into a fight, either verbally or even otherwise. So it, in terms of where that point is, where someone starts really getting hurt, and offending someone counts as hurting someone, in terms of where that point is and what are reasonable responsibilities, there's no hard and fast judgment procedure I can give you for that. It really amounts to the exercise of the virtue of prudence. You have to know what your audience is capable of handling, what your audience is going to respond to positively and negatively. And that involves judgment calls. Just like if you're a kid and you're wrestling with another kid, you have to know what can that kid handle, how are they going to respond if I do this or that. And you make your best call and trust the results to God.
How does that sit with you, Sophie?
Oh, fantastic. Thank you so much for answering my question.
No problem. My pleasure.
See you, Shorty.
Bye.
We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more.
Should that be shorty or shoddy?
Shoddy. Is shoddy a wave?
Shoddy is like the modern slang.
Oh. Yeah. I don't know if I should start calling her that.
You down with that, shoddy?
I've always called her shorty because she's tall.
Oh, okay.
We'll be right back after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In John 3:13, Jesus said to Nicodemus, "Just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the desert, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, so that everyone who believes in him may have eternal life." He was speaking here, of course, about his crucifixion. When one considers all the various means of capital punishment that have existed throughout history, none of us would ever dream of exalting or paying homage to any of them. Yet we hold the cross so dear that we Catholics even sign ourselves with it. Given the fact that we revere Jesus, who suffered so as a result of it, why do we not disdain the cross? It is his love that makes the difference. It is his presence on the cross that transforms it. Today we exult because we exult. We exult. We hold up this instrument of death because we exult. We rejoice in Jesus, who is our life. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Makes me nervous when my children call the show. I have no idea why. I guess I want to be
you
a proud
be
papa.
Proud.
I am proud.
That's a great
proud.
Question. I, and in fact, prompted me to articulate something in a way I hadn't before, because even though I've known about the connection between between comedy and laughter and play, I hadn't actually synced it in that tightly previously.
Yeah.
So I've viewed normally when I've talked about play and drama and how it prepares for handling yourself in conflict, I've talked about that as the basis for drama and horror.
Oh, yeah.
Which are also – that's why, you know, we have monster stories in every society.
Yeah.
And actually all drama involves danger of some sort. But I hadn't synced comedy in as part of that package, so that actually helped me out too.
Oh, very, very cool. Anonymous in Lillian, Alabama, listening on EWTN. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, my question is, I am a recent convert.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that if you have, if you want to get remarried to a Catholic person, you have to have an annulment.
If your previous spouse is still living.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question is, can you get like a papal dispensation due to all of the abuse that you went through and the amount of money that you've spent on, like, therapists and cognitive healing and, you know, because it's not something I want to revisit.
Okay. Well, so there are various grounds for annulment, and some of them are simple enough that they can be the church has a responsibility here. I should start by setting the framework. You know, Jesus said that when you're married to someone, you're married, and divorce does not entail a right to remarriage. This is something he goes into, for example, in Mark chapter 9. And so in order to give you permission to marry somebody else, the church needs to look at that first marriage in one way or another to see was it really valid from the beginning or not. And in the case of some marriages, it can be very easy to show that the marriage was not valid. And it may even involve only looking at certain documents. For example, if your first marriage was to someone who was a Catholic, and if the two of you didn't get married in a Catholic church and didn't get permission to have a non-Catholic marriage, well, then that marriage would have been automatically null. And so it would just be a matter of producing the correct documents to show that that's what happened, and it wouldn't require an extensive revisiting of the issues. And so for that kind of annulment, there's a special process known as the documentary process, because it only involves showing certain documents. So yeah, we married. Here's the context it occurred in. No, we didn't have permission for this kind of a marriage, and so that's why it's invalid. In many cases, though, the matter isn't so clear-cut, and the church needs to look more carefully at the details of the situation, and there can be a lengthier process that involves, for example, questionnaires. Asking, for example, in the case of, let's say there was abuse, how soon after the marriage did this begin, or did it even begin before the marriage? How severe was it? Things like that. They can all play a role in helping to establish whether or not the marriage was valid from the beginning. And so there is a need one way or another to look at the facts that pertained to this marriage. The church obviously wants to do that. It doesn't want to do that in an intrusive way. It wants to do that in a very compassionate way. And actually, a lot of people who've been through the process have said it helped bring them some closure and some insights and some healing that they hadn't previously had. And so what I would suggest is contacting your local parish and explaining the situation, and they can help you begin the process of looking at this situation so that you can determine whether the annulment process is something you want to pursue, and so that it can proceed in a very constructive way. Unfortunately, you know, we only have a few minutes here on the air, and so I can't, and I'm not qualified anyway, to go through all of the things that someone with a marriage tribunal would with you. But I can say that the church is there and it has compassion for everybody who's experienced a divorce and wants to help people make a determination in keeping with Christ's teachings that will suit them well for the future and help ultimately draw them closer to God and to Christ. And they want to be sensitive to the details of each individual's experience and be of as much assistance as they can in that discernment process.
Anonymous?
Okay, but why does a person who is not Catholic
need to go through an annulment?
To go through that process.
Okay.
Because, the church does not bless me, so...
Right. The reason is that people who are not Catholic don't have to be Catholic to get married. The church is – in some ways it functions like any other society, like a state. If you're a member – let's say you're a citizen of Alabama. Alabama can require its citizens to take out a marriage license in order to get validly married in Alabama. But if I'm a Texan – I don't have to take out a marriage license in Alabama to get validly married. I obey the laws of Texas. And in the same way, if someone is a Catholic, they need to either get a Catholic marriage, kind of the equivalent of taking out a marriage license. They either need to get married in the Catholic Church or get permission to have a non-Catholic marriage. But if someone's not a Catholic and has never been a Catholic, they're not bound by that. And so they can get married without that, just like two people in Texas can get married without taking out a marriage license in Alabama. And so because of that, the church assumes that the marriages of non-Catholics are valid and they need to be investigated just like anybody else's marriages.
Anonymous, I hope that was helpful to you. We're going to move on because we're trying to get one more call in here before the top of the hour. Steve in Columbus, Ohio, listening on St. Gabriel Radio. Your question, as quickly as you can, please, for Jimmy Akin.
Yes. Back in my Protestant days, I heard a pastor say that with prayer, it's best to say or to thank God for various things. Mm-hmm. You know, like thanks for helping my parents, or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that as good, or is that equal to saying, you know, please help my parents, or things like that? I mean, hopefully you can see the difference there.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It seems different to me. I mean, is one right versus wrong, or what?
Well, okay. So let's take a look at the model Christian prayer that Jesus gave us, known as the Lord's Prayer or the Our Father. Does the word thank you occur in the Lord's Prayer, psychelet?
No.
Right. So we don't always have to be saying thank you. Do requests for things occur in the Lord's Prayer, psychelet?
Yes.
Okay. So it's okay to ask for things. So we don't want to look at thanksgiving versus petitioning, that petitioning is asking for stuff. We don't want to look at those as if one is right and the other is wrong. Thanksgiving is not mandatory in every prayer, as evidenced by the fact it's not in the Lord's Prayer. Making requests is something that's permitted because it is something that occurs in the Lord's Prayer. And so we don't want to pit those against each other. And in fact, if you think about it, there are many different things you can do with prayer. Praising God is one of them. Thanking God is another. Asking God for something for yourself is a third. Asking God for something for someone else is another. There are even just experiencing God's presence. Just lifting your mind to God, that's a form of prayer too. Working, doing something to God's glory is a form of prayer. So there's many different forms of prayer, and we don't want to pit them against each other and say, well, you should be doing only this one or doing this one to the exclusion of something else. Having said that, there is a kind of hierarchy among the different forms of prayer. So obviously thanking God for something he's done, it shows gratitude, and being grateful is a virtue. There's nothing wrong with asking for things you need or even things you just want, but being grateful, I think we all sense, goes a little bit beyond that. We're not just focused on ourselves. We're focusing on God in a different way when we say thank you. And so both of those are good things to be doing. I would say, we want to make a point of thanking God. We want to make a point of praising God. We also want to ask him when we need or want things. I would say the key is don't worry, don't feel bad about asking for stuff, but also make a point of saying thank you too.
And thank you very much for that call. Jimmy Aiken, it's been so pleasant. I feel like we should do it again tomorrow. Will you come back tomorrow?
Yeah, sure. But I feel a little more austere. Maybe we should, I don't know, talk about fasting tomorrow.
Let's do that. Well, Jimmy Aiken will be here first hour tomorrow. We're going to talk about fasting, a whole hour devoted to fasting. And then in the second hour, Carrie Gress, for the first time, will be on Catholic Answers Live. We've had her on Focus, and you can find it there on Focus. How to Fight Like Mary, about her new book, The Marian Option. Thanks so much for being with us. God willing, we'll see you tomorrow. Catholic Answers Live.